I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. We're going to do something on the show today that you shouldn't do. We're going to talk about our convoluted, complex tax code, which is something like 10,000 pages long. And we're going to use Mitt Romney's last 2 years of tax returns released this week as a jumping off point to discuss the tax system, why investment income is treated differently from wages, the impact of loopholes and deductions, and what, if anything, would make a more equitable system. Mitt Romney earned most of his income from investments, and his effective federal tax rate was less than 14%. By way of contrast, Newt Gingrich's tax rate was about 32%, and President Obama's almost 28%. They are wealthy, but they all earned less than Mitt Romney. Joining us is Alice Abreu. She's a professor of law at Temple University's Beasley School of Law, where she specializes in federal income tax law. And Alice Abreu, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. We have a big task before us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
So how do we end up with such a convoluted, complex, 10,000-page tax code?
Well, that requires a longer answer than we have time for. But, you know, our tax laws are a reflection of our values, which manifest themselves in the political process. We don't agree on a lot of things, so we end up with a lot of changes to the tax law and complication.
Complication and lobbying. I mean, there's been a lot of work to create the system that we have. A lot of input, to say.
Absolutely. And the federal income tax isn't even 100 years old yet.
And we're going to focus on the federal income tax, because I think oftentimes when people talk about taxes, they lump in the payroll tax, for
Correct.
Instance. We're going to focus on the federal income tax.
Correct.
And that comes from wages, comes from investments.
Correct. So I think that we can divide it basically into three chunks. There are wages, or more broadly, compensation for services. Some of it is wages if you're an employee, but also, you know, if you're a house painter and you're an independent contractor, that's compensation mm-hmm. income. That is so-called ordinary income. Maximum rate of tax on that under current law is 35%.
Right.
Then you have income from investments, but not all investment income is treated the same. So in the realm of investment income, you have capital gains, right? We've all heard that. Capital gains is a technical term, and what it means is gain from the sale or exchange of a capital asset. The prototypical capital asset is a share of stock in a right. corporation. I sell that, I have gain, that's capital gain. Since 2003, however, dividends on corporate stock are also subject to tax like capital gains. That's not all corporate stock, and we actually see that on both the Romney and Gingrich returns. It's generally the dividends that get that favorable rate are dividends from domestic companies or dividends from foreign companies from countries with which we have tax treaties.
And looking at investments and looking at those dividends that you just described in capital gains, we're talking about a 15% rate.
Exactly. Maximum flat rate of 15%. No progressivity, flat rate 15%, no matter how much it is.
And you said there's a third?
And there's a third, and that is investment income that isn't capital gain. And the poster child example of that is rents from real estate. You own an apartment building, tenants pay you rent. That's income, and that's ordinary income. It's not capital gain because it's not gain from the sale mm-hmm. or exchange of a capital asset. And there's no provision that gives you a special break for it. So one of the reasons for the difference in the effective rates of Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich is that Mitt Romney's, the bulk of his income comes from capital gain or dividends that get the capital gains preference. The bulk of Newt Gingrich's income comes from rental real estate, ordinary income. And there's a difference.
And there's a difference. And it's almost twice as different. But why are capital gains and these dividends you described, why are they treated differently and taxed at this lower rate?
That's an excellent and not easy question. There are at least seven different reasons that have been advanced in support of the preference for capital gains, which has been with us since 1922.
Wow.
There was a brief period of time, perhaps ironically, during President Reagan's tenure from 86 to about 90, capital gains and ordinary income were taxed at the same rate, which was a much reduced rate than what ordinary income had been before, and that was part of the Great Compromise that gave us the 86 Act. But except for that brief period of time, we've had a preference. And so the reasons for the preference, one that you hear a lot about in the news is, well, capital gains are taxed twice.
Right.
And so we need to give them a break because it's double taxation. That argument proceeds from knowing that most capital gains come from corporate stock, either gain from the sale or exchange or a dividend. And corporations, we know, are subject to the corporate income tax. And so a lot of people say, well, it follows from that, that if you tax the money when the corporation receives it, and then you tax it again when the shareholder receives it, that's a double tax. The problem with that argument, there are at least three problems with that argument. One is it assumes that the corporation paying you the dividend or whose stock has increased in value actually paid the corporate income tax. And that is not necessarily true. I mean, we do have sort of notorious examples of corporations not paying income tax, like GE. But it is the case that not all corporations pay the 35% rate. In fact, there are some studies that show that in a seven-year period, about 55% of corporations didn't pay tax for at least 1 year.
And that would be a little more than half of corporations.
Correct. So that's one problem. Another problem is that it assumes that the corporation in question is subject to the U.S. tax. And that is not necessarily true, because you get the same capital gains break whether the corporation is a U.S. corporation or a foreign corporation. So that doesn't follow either. The final problem with that is that it assumes that the holder of capital, the shareholder, is actually bearing the economic burden of the corporate tax. And we don't know that. Nobody knows the answer to the question of who actually bears the corporate tax. Is it workers that get paid less because the corporation has to pay tax? Is it consumers that have to pay more for the goods that the corporation produces because there's a corporate tax? Or is it the holders of capital? Lots of ink has been spilled by economists trying to answer that question.
But even going back to Mitt Romney, and to use him as an example, but in terms of his income, and it's called carried interest.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Getting us further into the weeds. But for him, he's not paying taxes twice.
Well, that depends on how you view whether the capital gain that he's getting from the corporations in which Bain Capital invested were themselves subject to tax, and whether you can say that that was passed through to him as the owner of capital. The further problem with carried interest, though, is that that represents a percentage of the profit of Bain Capital in his case. And the reason that's a problem is that, or it's perceived as a problem, is that private equity fund managers and hedge fund managers usually get compensated by getting a 2% fee based on the assets that are under management, and then they get a percentage of the profits of the enterprise. They're getting that for managing the money, which some folks say that's personal services. That ought to be taxed like wages and compensation income, because that's why you're getting it. Mm-hmm. But the way the tax law is structured, what they receive is actually an interest in a partnership. And partnerships are transparent entities. There's no tax at the entity level. So if I have the right to get 20% of the interest in a partner of the income of a partnership, and the income of the partnership happens to be capital gain because it's a private equity firm, they're buying companies and selling companies or getting dividends from companies, then what I get is capital gain because it passes through to me.
Mm.
So the problem is in the characterization of the interest.
But also, it's we're talking about a system where it seems like there is transparency in some ways. I think for people getting wages, money is taken out every 2 weeks, taken out of that paycheck. In this case, we're talking about people that are paying taxes sort of after the fact.
Yes, although somebody like Romney is required to make estimated tax payments, quarterly estimated tax payments. One of the interesting things about the Romney return is that he actually got a $1.6 million refund.
Oh.
And the reason is...
And I should say that our guest has brought in one of Mitt Romney's returns. And how many pages is it?
It's about 203 pages, okay. The 2010 return.
Okay.
And so he paid, according to his return, $1.3 million during the year. And then he filed his return not on April 15th, which is perfectly legal. He got an automatic extension to October 15th. But when you get an extension, you're still responsible for paying the amount of the tax.
Right.
And so when he gets the extension, he sends in an additional $3.2 million to cover the estimated tax liability. When the return is actually done, it turns out that he only owes about $3 million in taxes, so he gets a $1.6 million refund.
And we should say, and this is all perfectly legal.
Absolutely.
I mean, and we, you know, his tax returns have gotten a great deal of coverage and press this week, but we're not talking about anything illegal.
No, we're this talking about the operation of the tax system. He has investments in companies offshore under the U.S. tax system. That is, any income that those companies throw off is subject to U.S. tax, and it's reported on his return.
Now, one of the arguments that I read in support of this lower tax rate, this 15%, is that this money, these are companies that are creating jobs, they're investing in the economy, they need this kind of financial encouragement to help the economy overall.
That is absolutely an argument that is made, that you need to provide a lower rate of tax to induce folks to take a risk. Of course, you could counter that there is nothing in the law that limits that preferential rate of tax to investments and jobs created in the United States. It just doesn't. No matter where the money's invested, if it's the right kind of money, you get the break. Another of the arguments that's given in support of the preference for capital gains is that some of that gain reflects inflation.
Mm-hmm.
If I bought stock in 1950 and I sell it now, it's gone up in value, but some of that reflects inflation. So maybe we need to do rough justice. Maybe if I get all of my money now, rather than having recognized it over ratably over the time that I held the asset, it's going to put me up into a higher bracket. So again, a reduced rate of tax, the argument goes, is rough justice. On the other hand, some people say, well, geez, but a dollar is a dollar.
Right.
And if a dollar is a dollar, all dollars ought to be treated equal. Whether you think that that is correct really depends on your values. You know, do you value incentivizing risk-taking, or do you value treating every dollar the same? Capital gains, the preference for capital gains, adds tremendous complexity to the tax code. Because, you know, you got to make distinctions. And in addition, it's arguably economically inefficient, because if a certain kind of investment will be taxed at a preferential rate, you're going to be induced to do that investment rather than another investment. That may be a fine thing for you to do, and we may want to encourage you that way, but it's not neutral.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Alice Abreu. She's a professor of law at Temple University's Beasley School of Law. She specializes in the federal income tax law. That's what we're talking about today on Radio Times, talking about Mitt Romney's federal income tax returns. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Doctors at Penn's Depression Research Unit have been studying the causes and treatment of mood disorder since 1964 and are currently performing research to develop improved treatments. Symptoms may include mood swings, low energy, and low motivation. Initial evaluations are offered to determine those who are eligible for treatment. More about Penn's Depression Research Unit at 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
This November, one of the biggest prizes in the presidential race will be Florida's 29 electoral votes. But the state is already a battleground as the Republican candidates fight for the chance to take on President Obama in the fall. I'm Robert Siegel. Primary voters in Florida head to the polls on Tuesday, and NPR News will bring you results, reaction, and analysis. Live coverage of the Florida primary from NPR News.
Tuesday night at 8 on WHYY.
Sign up now for classes at WHYY's Dorrance H. Hamilton Public Media Commons. Starting February 2nd, learn the art of audio storytelling. Use WHYY's state-of-the-art equipment to combine narration and interviews while crafting a short audio piece on a topic of your choice. For more information on courses at WHYY's Hamilton Commons, visit whyy.org/Hamilton Commons.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking about federal income taxes, our system of federal income tax in this country. We are not talking about the payroll tax. We're not talking about sales tax. We are focusing our conversation on our tax system and how the federal government taxes people's wages and investments. And again, our guest is Alice Abreu, professor of law at Temple University's Beasley School of Law. And as I said at the top of the show, this is complicated stuff. We're doing the best that we can without a blackboard on the radio. Going back to Mitt Romney's return, we're also talking about some investments in the Cayman Islands. Help us understand what that is about and how common is something like that?
Well, investments in the Cayman Islands, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, Ireland, which are all sort of known tax havens, meaning they tax investments at a very low or zero rate, are not illegal. The U.S. taxes its U.S. citizens and residents on a worldwide system. So if you have invested in a corporation located offshore, that's perfectly legal. It's supposed to be reported on your return. From Romney's return, it's hard to tell exactly what those investments are because a lot of it is passed through trusts, and he has a blind trust, and so it's hard to tell. There's actually not much income attached to it. Most of Romney's income comes from the Bain Capital carried interest.
So it's legal to have your money in an offshore account, but you just have to pay the taxes on it.
Exactly. And of course, the problem, as we learned from the UBS debacle, is that a lot of folks want to put money in an offshore account thinking, well, there's bank secrecy, and so if the IRS can't know about it, I don't have to report it, which is that's illegal.
Mm. Now, he has deductions, as many people have deductions in their tax form, and whether it's mortgage or charitable deduction.
No mortgage on either one of them.
Okay. I guess he doesn't have to worry about a mortgage.
Correct.
Does he?
There are real estate taxes, but no home mortgage interest.
But there are deductions.
Yes. On Romney's return, probably the most substantial deductions are charitable contributions. It's about a $3 million charitable contribution deduction. About half of it was in cash to the Mormon Church. The other half was to the Tyler Foundation, which is a Romney family foundation. Mm-hmm. And one interesting thing about that is that the donations to the foundation were in the form of stock, whereas the donations to the Mormon Church are in the form of cash. And that's interesting because Tax Planning 101 would tell you making donations in the form of stock, this is another sort of quirk in our tax system, mm-hmm. if it's appreciated stock is better, because if I bought a share of stock for a dollar and it's now worth 100 and I donate that to charity, my deduction is 100. Even though I never took into income the difference. If I instead sell the stock, get the money, the $100, and donate that to charity, I still get a deduction for 100, but I had income of 99. Yeah. So the deduction doesn't shelter other income. There's a fabulous clip from a Paul Newman movie called The Young Philadelphians, in which Paul Newman plays a tax lawyer, and he points that out. So it's interesting that Romney's is half cash and half stock.
Interesting. Now, the tax code is about 10,000 pages. Can I assume that you have read our tax code?
Not cover to cover. I don't know that there's any human who has done that. And even if they had read it, would they remember it? Mm. I don't think so.
And I'm assuming it's written in that sort of arcane language that we associate with tax codes.
Well, you know, a lot of it is. Some of it, where you think that, you know, it would be very complicated, isn't. The definition of income in the code is gross income is income from whatever source derived, period. We leave it to the courts and the IRS to figure out what counts as income. The capital gains provision, terrifically complex. The provisions dealing with these offshore investments, so-called passive foreign passive investment companies, beyond most humans' comprehension.
Let me ask you about the Buffett rule. This is something that the president talked about. In fact, had Warren Buffett's secretary sitting with the first lady just to right. underscore his point. But the idea that a hedge fund manager or someone head of a private equity firm would pay a lesser effective tax rate than their secretary. Apparently, his secretary gets paid something like $60,000. The idea of the kind of unfairness in the system. Do you see it that way?
Frankly, yes, I do. I think that the idea of having a what's generally referred to as a minimum tax, as some amount that some percentage of your adjusted gross income as a minimum payment into the government, my concept of fairness says that's fair.
And a minimum meaning more than 15%, or?
I think if the maximum rate of tax on wages is 35%, mm-hmm. the minimum, once you get to some level of great wealth, should mm-hmm. be close to that. But, you know, that's because I believe that taxes should be based on ability to pay.
Hmm. And so the richer you are,
the greater proportion of your income you should contribute to the general good.
Interestingly, and I think this is something I read in the New York Times, that while people are upset about Romney's tax rate of 15%, as it turns out, many Americans making wages, you know, with a job and getting that paycheck, are paying close to that 15%.
That is true, and there are also a lot of wage earners that have no positive tax liability, and there are at least two reasons for that. One is that our tax code is progressive. Bottom rate under current law is 10%, and then it goes up. There are a total of six brackets, and it goes up to 35. So depending on how little you make, you may not pay even 15%. In addition, the tax system is structured so that you don't pay federal income tax on the first dollar that you earn. Everybody's entitled to the standard deduction. Everybody's entitled to a personal exemption. So everybody gets those. And those are pegged to be at about the poverty level. Hmm. So the design of the system is that if you're working but you're at or about the poverty level, no positive tax liability. But the second complication there is that since about 1975, but growing exponentially in the 90s, we now use the tax system not just to get money from people, from the private sector to the public sector, but the tax system is now the biggest redistributor of wealth to low-income Americans. So that places the IRS in the dual role of being both the collector and distributor, and that's a bit schizophrenic. But so when you hear that a lot of folks don't pay taxes, that in part is because we're using the tax system to redistribute money that used to be redistributed through welfare.
Now, we've been focusing largely on the federal tax, but we should add that people do pay taxes, whether it's sales tax or the payroll tax. I mean, there are other ways that the government gets its money.
Absolutely, and state and local taxes. And in fact, for most Americans, it is estimated that the payroll tax burden is higher than the income tax burden.
And that gets taken out of that paycheck every week or two.
Both because it gets taken out of the paycheck at a rate of about 7.5%, and that, unlike the federal income tax, is on the first dollar right. that you make.
So it's regressive?
It's regressive if you look only at the payments. It's less regressive if you look at the system as a whole of the Social Security pay amounts that you pay into the system, but then when you get later, when you retire or become disabled. The other side of that is that economists believe that the employee bears both halves of the payroll tax. Payroll tax has two halves. Half of it is taken out of your paycheck. The other half, your employer pays. So the argument is when your employer hires you, the employer knows that they're going to have to pay you your salary. Even if they pay you not a penny of benefits, they also have to pay that 7.5%. Right. So presumably, that's coming out of your hide because it would have otherwise been salary to you.
Well, let me just quickly reintroduce you, and I do want to get some callers in on the conversation. We are talking about our federal income tax system with Alice Abreu, professor of law at Temple University's Beasley School of Law. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Craig from Los Angeles to join us. And Craig, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, I've just been listening for the last 5 or 10 minutes, and I'm fascinated, and I think it's important because I fall into a unique category. My wife and I are married. We live in California. We both are working employees of Fortune 500 companies. We do not work for hedge funds. Both of us pay at the top 35% federal income tax bracket. We also pay the state income tax in California of 10%. And I think when the Buffett rule, quote, for the president is mentioned, it leaves out a vast majority of the upper 1% of income earners that are really paying more than our fair share. And I don't get a 15% capital gains rate on a hedge fund manager's percentage. And I personally listen to what you're saying. I have a really difficult time when the vast majority of the upper 1% are paying 35% federal income tax. There's a very, very small percentage in that group that are making $10-plus million a year. My wife and I make about $750,000 a year. And after taxes, almost half of that is gone. I'm not complaining, but at the same time, it's pretty oppressive. And
well, you know,
I'm
what, Craig?
Sure.
Yeah, Craig, let me take your point. It's a good one, and I want to give Alice Abreu a chance to weigh in. And we've been talking about, I guess, a subset of this 1%, Alice.
Well, I think, you know, the caller is absolutely right, and he illustrates the fundamental problem with our system that distinguishes between the taxation of labor income, wages, and the taxation from investments. And there are many people in his situation, and he and his wife's situation. If you receive the bulk of your money from wages, even if your wages or your compensation for services is several million dollars, you're subject to the top rate of 35%.
But it sounds like those that want to use this so-called Buffett rule, they want to take the people that are making the 15% and make them more like Craig.
Correct. But again, that's a policy choice. You could also say if the people that are paying the 15% on the mega millions of dollars were paying more, maybe we could afford to lower the rate of tax on people like Craig.
Thanks for calling in. Let's see what Desiree from Salt Lake City has to say. And Desiree, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that I think that a lot of the outrage people are feeling has nothing to do with what the effective tax rate is insofar as it's legal. I think what people are upset about is the fact that as a regular employee, you're not given an option for deferred compensation, and you're not given an option to be able to take advantage of a lot of these tax havens, and while they're legal, they're not fair because everyone's not entitled to them.
Hmm. Well, Desiree, you raise a good point. Let me get Alice to respond.
Well, you're absolutely right, and in recent years, the government has actually tightened everybody's ability to take deferred compensation. But, you know, on some level, doing these transactions and getting sophisticated tax advice and engaging in these sophisticated tax planning techniques is not cost-free. You end up paying a tax lawyer or an accountant and a broker, and so you have to have a certain amount of capital to invest mm-hmm. where it makes sense for you to incur those transaction costs.
Desiree, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let's see what Rita from Cinnaminson has to say. And Rita, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I wanted to say that in just listening to the conversation, first of all, it sounds like you have to be very highly educated to really understand and take advantage of all of these benefits that Romney has taken advantage of, especially with regard to the charitable donation of stock. But I wanted to say that it always puzzled me about unemployment compensation. Now, I feel as though, you know, I worked for a very long time, and through my paychecks, you know, I was paying into the unemployment fund. And then when I received my unemployment benefits after getting laid off, I had to include that in my income tax. And I felt that that was completely unfair because I was not earning that income. It was from a benefit that I had paid into. So isn't that, in essence, like a double taxation?
Go ahead, Rita.
Well, that's a really good point. And the tax law has actually been a bit schizophrenic on this. The theory for why you are required to treat unemployment compensation as income is that it's treated as a substitute for your wages. Mm. And so the idea is it's a substitute for your wages. Your wages would have been income, so the substitute for the wages is income. Of course, that ignores the fact that it's a substitute for wages and it's less than the wages. And you would think that that shouldn't be taxed. There was, in fact, a short period of time very recently when it was not included in income, but now we're back to the old system where you're absolutely right. Mm. It's income, and I don't necessarily agree with the reason, but that's the reason.
Rita, thanks for calling into Radio Times. We have just a couple minutes before we have to say goodbye here. We're talking about our complicated, convoluted tax system. Do you think there's any evidence that out of all the sort of complaints and even learning more about Mitt Romney's tax returns and Newt Gingrich's and President Obama's, that we're going to have a simple, I don't know if we can have a fairer system, but a simpler system?
I'm not optimistic about that. I'm a little more optimistic that we may get some changes in our tax system, that, you know, this carried interest issue is back on the front page and it's back on the radar screen of Congress, and legislation has yet again been introduced. But legislation on this has been introduced numbers of times before. It hasn't gone anywhere. Whether the increased visibility and, you know, that this has provided will push it forward, I wish I had a crystal ball.
Hmm. And it's so interesting to me that, you know, Congress is shocked to learn about all this when it's Congress who writes all these tax laws.
That's true. Although, you know, the carried interest thing came about because of an interesting confluence of different provisions of the law that weren't necessarily put together in that particular way until fairly recently.
Hmm.
So that's part of the complexity of the tax law, that you write the, you know, Congress writes the law thinking it is doing X, but then people figure out how to put it together in a way that provides for Y.
But does that tell you about the influence of lobbyists to get the kinds of laws that would benefit their people?
Absolutely. And the lobbyists have been out in force in support of keeping the law on carried interest as it is.
Right. And in fact, I heard some members of Congress talking about when all this lobbying was going on, how intense it was to get this carried interest system that we have today.
There's a lot of money involved. And if you just look at the fact that, you know, 15% is less than half of what otherwise would be paid. And so when you're talking about 15% versus 35% of a very large number, there are a lot of dollars involved in that, and people are going to spend a lot of money to try to keep it. Now, to be fair, there are other folks that say, well, gee, fixing the problem is technically difficult, and you don't want to overstep it and end up going too far. I personally think those problems can be fixed.
Mm. And are taxes down, or I guess are taxes paid to the federal government, are they down?
Generally, when the economy is down and people are making less money, then tax revenues also go down, and we certainly see that in the states.
Well, Alice Abreu, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times, bringing some clarity to our very complicated federal tax system. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And she's a professor of law at Temple University's Beasley School of Law. She specializes in federal income tax law and actually brought in one of Mitt, I guess that's the 2010 Mitt Romney's 2010 tax return, just to show us all, or certainly show me, just how many pages we are talking about. We have David K. Johnson waiting in the wings. We will continue our conversation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
St. Joseph's University Graduate Studies in the Arts and Sciences supports WHYY and offers over 41 full and part-time master's and certificate programs on campus or online. A cohort is forming now for the Interdisciplinary Doctorate in Educational Leadership, a program that prepares new leaders marked by the vision, skills, and values to help shape the future of education. Information at sju.edu/edd. Graduate studies at St. Joseph's University. Higher knowledge, higher potential.
Did the economic stimulus program amount to a costly failure or save us from a depression? Investigative reporter Michael Graybell scoured records and traveled the country for his new book, Money Well Spent. Hear his assessment of the stimulus program on the next Fresh Air. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. In the intelligence business, they call it a false flag operation. Israeli spies posing as American CIA agents to recruit terrorists to attack Iran. Also, it won a big award for best new map, but it came from a very small company, actually just one guy. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. As we all know by now, Mitt Romney released his 2009-2010 tax returns, showing that he makes most of his money from investments and paid less than 15% in federal taxes. So what do Romney's taxes say about our country's tax code, and is there a fairer, better way to deal with our tax system? And joining us now is David K. Johnston. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author, tax columnist for Reuters, won a Pulitzer Prize back in 2001. He's the author of several books, including Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense. His latest, The Fine Print, How Big Companies Abuse Plain English and Other Tricks to Rob You Blind, being published this month. And David K. Johnston, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Won't be out this month. It's going to take a little longer, but it'll be out sometime this year.
Well, we await that publication. So to you, what does Mitt Romney's tax return tell us about our federal tax code?
Well, America has two income tax systems, separate and unequal. One is for wage earners. You don't even get your money until the taxes are taken out of it. Everything that's significant is independently reported to the government. The other is for people who Congress trusts, unlike wage earners, to fully report their taxes. And within that group of business owners, investors, especially multinational ones, there's an even more special group, which Mr. Romney is in. And these are people who are able to be paid for their labor as managers of investment partnerships while delaying receipt of a good part of their money, and the money they do get is taxed as if it were capital gains, even though their money is not at risk. The money at risk is that of the clients that they are investing.
So this is other people's money you're talking about?
It's other people's money. What Mr. Romney has is a share of the profits from deals he made long ago. And interestingly, in Romney's case, you know, if you leave WHYY, they're not going to keep paying you. If I leave Reuters, they're not going to keep paying me. But when Mr. Romney left Bain, he made a deal to continue to be paid for the as long as the deals he had set up continued, and that's why he has this tremendous income, more than $20 million a year, and why he pays an effective tax rate, that is the share of his income paid in federal income taxes, of less than 15%.
Well, and I asked Alice Abreu, our first guest, this question, and I'll ask it to you, David K. Johnston. So how did Mitt Romney get to be part of this special group, as you describe?
Well, he created an investment partnership, and he's very good at it. I mean, obviously, the numbers show that he was very successful at what he was doing. By the way, you asked something of Alice. I also teach law, though I'm a lecturer, not a professor.
Okay.
And the fact is, federal income taxes are smaller today than they were in 2001, a recession year. When you adjust for inflation and for the growth of the population, individual income taxes are down one-third. Now, remember, the tax cuts that President Bush promoted were all sold on the notion of, A, there's surpluses as far as the eye can see, which immediately disappeared and turned into record deficits, and B, that they would spawn enormous economic growth, especially the 2003 cuts for investors that gave us the 15% rate. Well, that's not at all what happened. So the
the performance has not matched the promise, and that's what we should be focused on, that this policy did not work.
Well, let me just pick up on that, and again, and this is something that Alice Abreu and I talked about, which the idea behind this lower tax rate is that these are the entrepreneurs, these are the investors, these are the people who are making our economic engine run. Therefore, they need this special lower tax rate.
These are, in the case of private equity funds and hedge funds, these are speculators. Some of them are people like Mr. Romney was, who go in and actually run businesses. But let me give you an example of what Romney did. In some cases, he created wealth and added wealth. He likes to cite Staples and claim credit for every job Staples has added since its founding, not during the period he was there. But Staples is retail. Every job created at Staples resulted in a mom-and-pop stationery store or other less efficient supplier going out of business. Now, that's not arguing that we should have inefficient businesses. I don't want us replacing steam shovels at construction sites with teaspoons. But that's not job creation. That's just job transfer from one employer to another. And because these are more efficient, fewer jobs.
Let me just read something. Actually, Alice Abreu is listening in, and she just passed something across the table to me. David K. Johnson, she said, the top capital gains rate is lower now than under President Reagan. Now it's 15%, and under Ronald Reagan it was 28%.
Yes, and we had, as the Wall Street Journal loves to remind everybody, what were called the seven fat years. We also had the capital gains rate when it was 28, the same as the top marginal earned income rate. And the fundamental argument here, well, if you don't lower these people's taxes, they won't do any work. Well, think about that for a moment. We know from research that's been done that people set a target for how much they want to leave their children if that's one of their goals. And if you have an estate tax, we know from survey information and some behavioral experiments that people will save more so that they can pay whatever taxes due and leave the amount they want to their children. Mm-hmm. In business, I don't know any business owner, including some of my neighbors and many executives I've interviewed over the years, and Paul O'Neill, the former Treasury Secretary, who ran one of the biggest companies in America, Alcoa, who allow taxes to drive their decisions. As Paul O'Neill famously said, first you make the money, then you worry about the taxes.
Well, and talking about the need for job creation in this country, you need consumers, do you not, in order to have in order to create the jobs?
Yes, an absolutely fundamental principle on a global level in economics. Income equals spending. Spending equals income. Everybody's spending in the world determines everybody's income in the world. If you reduce incomes, you reduce spending. If you reduce spending, you reduce income. So when private incomes from the private sector are down, the only way to maintain the economy is for government to increase spending to offset that.
Is that because wealthy people, even if they have lots and lots of money, they just can't not spend all that money in order to keep the economy afloat?
Yes. In fact, I have a little game I play with people where I ask them, how much can you consume? And there are rules. You have to work 50 hours a week, and you get 2 weeks paid vacation, but you can never run out of money. And people say, well, I'm gonna buy a bunch of mansions. Well, I'm sorry, that's just converting dollars into an asset, housing. Let's talk about actual consumption. Well, I'm going to go have dinner at Le Cirque every night. Okay, we'll give you $10,000 a night for dinner at Le Cirque with wine. By the way, at the end of the year, when you weigh 400 pounds and die of a heart attack, and how are you going to go to work the next day after this?
That's not a fair. But, yeah, no, go ahead. Go ahead.
Most people, I've played this game with more than 100 people. Most people can't consume more than about $400,000. And the wealthiest people I've played this game with were not generally able to consume more than about $2.5 million.
Wow. But let me go back, and this goes back to our federal income taxes. And again, something like the top 1% pays about 40% of the federal income tax. Is that correct?
Yes, but their incomes have been rising faster than their taxes, so their tax burden has been falling. I mean, you have to look at that in terms of share of income. The top 400 taxpayers in America make as much income as a group of 11,000 taxpayers were making 30 years ago. The income pie has been recut. The bottom 90% of Americans in 1980 got two-thirds of all the income. Now they get half. That means the top 10% gets almost half the income in this country, and within that group, half goes to the top 1%, and within that group, half goes to the top half of 1%. With that group, more than half goes to the top tenth of 1%. And with that group, about half goes to the top hundredth of 1%, the group Romney's in, because he's in the top 1% of the top 1%.
And do poor people pay taxes?
They pay lots of taxes, but not federal income taxes if they have children. If you're a single person, you start paying federal income taxes at about $9,300 of income. If you have a family with two children, thanks to the Republicans, you don't pay income taxes until you make about low $40,000. I'm not sure exactly what the cutoff point is now.
And that's David K. Johnston. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author, and a tax columnist for Reuters, joining us today on Radio Times as we talk about our tax system. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. David, it always just, when you go back to the years of Ronald Reagan, it'd be interesting to think if he could even run as a Republican these days. But he's raised taxes something like 11 times when he was president, called it many times revenue enhancers. I don't know whether it was just a semantic workaround.
That's exactly what it was. They persuaded the press corps, the White House press corps, to call them revenue enhancers. Reagan raised taxes 11 times, particularly the payroll tax.
And why is it so impossible to raise taxes today? I mean, that just, you know, the president talks about it, raising taxes on high-income earners. But why is that such a controversial issue today?
Because members of Congress owe their re-election to a narrow group of wealthy people who don't want to pay taxes. If you were a member of Congress, I want to be sympathetic to these guys. I've talked to more than 100 members of Congress and the Senate over the years about this. If you're a member of Congress, your concerns, your incentives all have to do with wealthy donors. They have nothing to do with Joe Sixpack.
And so what wealthy donors want, donors get?
Those wealthy donors who are focused on taxes will press. Now, you have Grover Norquist's organization that has gotten all these signatories to this Never Raise Taxes pledge, which I've shown has been conveniently violated when it was convenient. And secondly, you have the Club for Growth, which goes after those Republicans who in any way are willing to raise taxes for the national good. And I've suggested in my Reuters column that anyone who signed the Grover Norquist pledge has violated his constitutional oath of office if he puts that pledge ahead of his oath.
What would be a fairer system, a more equitable and fair system from your perspective? Then I want to get a couple of callers in.
Yeah. The principle we should follow is the most conservative principle in Western civilization. It's 2,500 years, and its moral basis comes to us from ancient Athens, and it was intimately connected with the creation of democracy. There is no wealth in man's natural state in the jungle. When you live in a civilized society that makes wealth possible, the greater your gain, the greater your duty to give back to that society with taxes so that it will endure and others can have the same opportunity.
And you're talking about a progressive tax system.
That's exactly right. Exactly what the rates are is a political matter. And the other thing we've forgotten in this country because of all the people who fostered a hatred of taxes is that taxes are the foundation of all wealth. If there are no taxes, there is no wealth. That doesn't mean taxes can't destroy wealth. They can, but the foundation is taxes.
And should there be deductions from your perspective?
Well, I think you want to have a system which it promotes wealth creation, promotes people to save and not do as we have a society where a majority of taxpayers report no taxable savings. And we want a society that taxes more heavily as your income goes up. As it is now, the top tax rate starts applying to people at about $390,000, $400,000. That sounds like a lot of money. Yeah. But we have people in America who make several million dollars a day. And they pay the same they pay a lower tax rate, actually, than people who are making $400,000 a year.
Well, let me get a couple of callers on before we have to say goodbye. We have, looks like, Bud from Germantown joining us on Radio Times. Bud, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I was calling because of the comment about earlier in the show about corporations paying 35% in tax. And I gave you person there an example. Back in the 80s.
Well, you know what, Bud, if you don't mind, only because I'm looking at the clock, and can you just ask your question?
Yeah. All of the major law firms in this country have tax divisions that help corporations shelter profits. And an example is United States Steel from 1980. When it went out of the steel business, closing its steel mills, which were profitable, but not as profitable as an oil company, which they then bought. And they sheltered all of the profits from the oil company for years to come with tax loss carry-forwards that they earned by shutting down the steel mills.
Right. But that's a good point.
Go ahead, David K. Johnson.
Well, we have a system that allows corporations to keep, requires corporations to keep two sets of books, and this began in 1954. And when we have big corporations that have tax losses they carry forward, often they don't get materialized because the company disappears, or they turn into a benefit in another way. And one of the things I've argued for is we should go to a unified set of books. What you tell your shareholders is your profit is what you should pay taxes on now. It would simplify the system and eliminate all these complaints about how difficult it is to comply with the tax laws.
Indeed. Well, but
corporations hate that idea, by the way. None of them want it.
I can only imagine. But thanks for calling into Radio Times. David, we have about a minute before we have to say goodbye here, but I'm thinking about, you know, the small business person. Are they disadvantaged by our system? And I realize that's a broad category.
Well, I'm the chairman of the board of a small business in New Jersey. We try to... like most small businesses, really small ones, we try at the end of the year to have zero profit or as little profit as we can. And we'll, if there's extra money, we'll put it in a retirement plan or whatever. When you have a high tax rate, it says to a small business owner, reinvest that money, buy new equipment, buy new plant, expand your operations to avoid the tax, turn what would be a profit into a business expense that builds your business. With our low tax rate at 15% in a pass-through business, we encourage people to withdraw from the business as dividends, and that, in the long run, destroys jobs because there's less capital.
And that seems paradoxical, that the higher the taxes, the more a company's going to, in a sense, hire people or invest in their company.
That's true. What I'm talking about applies to capital-intensive businesses. Right. There are a number of studies showing that if we had a corporate tax rate as high as 65%, it would not lead to any less economic growth than what we have now.
Because companies take advantage of that and hire people and buy things and improve their company, for instance?
And they would be reinvesting in the business and creating retained wealth within the business. Instead, we have a system that literally subsidizes companies to go offshore. We have companies that put their intellectual property offshore. So every time Pfizer sells a for $18, a royalty payment goes from the U.S. to its European subsidiary. It's a tax expense in America, and it's untaxed profit overseas.
Well, David K. Johnson, it's been a couple of years. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author, tax columnist for Reuters. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. Alice Abreu also joined us in this hour, professor of law at Temple University's Beasley School of Law. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.